Blog Talk Radio.
Afternoon, everyone. It is a gorgeous summer day here in Fairfax, Virginia, and this is Military Monday. I am your host, John Gresham, and today we're going to talk about a subject that I'm finding is a lot better known and a lot more enjoyed by people in America than I had thought, and that is the subject of the Swamp Fox, Francis Marion, folks. Now, this is turning out to be something that I had forgotten from my youth, but Francis Marion is one of the best known figures of the American Revolutionary War, a wonderful and courageous and very, very charismatic leader who led guerrilla forces in the Carolinas and Georgia during the Revolutionary War. But what a lot of people don't know is that he was actually one of the founding fathers of American Special Operations. His tactics, his organization, his methods of fighting were centuries ahead of his own time. And today we're going to have a rather great guest who is going to talk to us about the Swamp Fox. His name is Colonel Scott Aiken. He's a Marine colonel, and he has just written a new book for U.S. Naval Institute called The Swamp Fox. Obviously enough. And Colonel, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. Greetings from Norfolk.
And I'm sure it's gorgeous in Norfolk today.
Yes, sir, it is. A little cooler. It's about 79 and partly cloudy.
Now, Colonel, let's start right out and just say that who is or who was Francis Marion? And how did he fit in colonial America before and during the Revolutionary War?
Okay, John, just a quick history on General Marion. First of all, there's 4 points about his life that I feel is important as we lead up to the American Revolution. He was a native South Carolinian, so he knew very well the land and its people. Secondly, he was a wealthy planter that gave him access into the militia and political leadership of then the colony. He was a militia leader. He served in the French and Indian War, and he was also a leader in the 2nd South Carolina Regiment during the Revolutionary War. He fought at Fort Moultrie to repel the British in 1776, just outside of Charleston, and he took part in the unsuccessful siege and assault on Savannah a couple of years later down in Georgia. He's also a state legislator, and the political leadership that he had in the latter part of the war and the end of the war serves as a very good blend for the political-military blend that you see in today's counterinsurgencies. And of note, he is also a member of the U.S. Army Ranger Hall of Fame.
So this man very much qualifies as one of our founding fathers. He may not have signed the Constitution, but this is one of the guys without whom there wouldn't be an America today.
I attribute and I give credit for General Marion as saving South Carolina from succumbing to British control during the period in which Charleston was captured in May of 1780, and then you had the disastrous Battle of Camden in August 16th of 1780. He held, along with Thomas Sumner and Andrew Pickens, who they were in different parts of the state, he held kind of the low country and kept it in turmoil until Major General Nathaniel Greene's army to recover the southern colonies started in the latter part of that year around about December. So there's about 5 or 6 months that I attribute that if he weren't here, we would have had a different outcome, specifically in the southern campaign.
Now let's talk a little about that, sir. What was the situation there in 1780. What had happened in the South, and why were the British working so hard to take the South at this point, as opposed to their efforts in New England and the Mid-Atlantic states?
Well, the way I interpret it is you have a kind of a stalemate everywhere further north. So the British decided that they would try to recapture the southern colonies. I guess in some instances, it's, you know, you've tried in a couple locations and it didn't work, you'll try somewhere else. There's also always a lot of rumor out there that if the British were to show up in force, that the loyalist of the southern colonies would come out in force and help beat down the Patriots. And you see that as early as February of 1776 at the Battle of Moore's Creek up in North Carolina, just inland from Wilmington. That was one of the sound bites that the then-exiled North Carolinian colonial governor used to try to entice folks to come to his aid. And I think you hear that from time to time throughout as you approach this time frame. So, again, they do go in with overwhelming mass. You know, the capture of Charleston in May of 1780 was a very poor situation indeed for the southern colonies, and it lost a large number. We lost a large number of Continental and the militia forces during that time, and then of course Gates rushes down and tries to rekindle the fires, and then pretty much everybody else that wasn't captured at Charleston gets scattered or captured at Camden. So again, when Marion begins his campaign, it's a dire circumstances in that area.
And a lot of people need to understand that very much those southern states were very much the breadbasket of the revolution, in that they produced a lot of the food, a lot of the raw materials, and other things that were sustaining the revolution for the other colonies as well, of course.
Yes, and I just read a book recently by Hugh Rankin, one of his old books on the North Carolina Continentals, and I think the book could be re-entitled North Carolina Logistics, because just time and time again he talks about the importance of the supplies that the southern colonies were providing, and at times when they're there, either you had bad weather or you had lots of armies of both sides moving north to south, they would pick certain areas clean. So by all means, the South was definitely a key part of a control of it would be key for either side.
And what was the makeup of the British forces in the Carolinas and Georgia at this time? Obviously, they had their own regulars, mercenaries, but did they not also have a large number of loyalist Americans who were fighting on the British side?
They did. They did have a lot of loyalists, and there were times when Marion would go to the field that he would fight an entire band of loyalists, and it would be a force that did not contain a single British or German soldier. So what you see up in the Battle of Kings Mountain that occurred in October of 1780 up in the very border of North and South Carolina, where Major Patrick Ferguson was the only British person on the field of about 2,000 combatants, you would see that on a micro scale and a very localized scale in and around certain areas of South Carolina, to where you would have bands of loyalists and bands of patriots kind of geographically separated, and then one would try to exert control over the other, and then you would have these, you know, skirmishes, frequent skirmishes and engagements.
So it is 1780. The South is essentially lost. And there is the very real possibility of the British going and turning right and heading up through the Carolinas into Virginia and the Mid-Atlantic states. What is the response of Francis Marion, and why in the world does he go and make the decision he's going to go guerrilla on the British?
Well, I would imagine for the general it was a very lonely feeling. He had evacuated out of Charleston before its capture by the British. That's a key point. He had either broken or sprained his ankle very severely, and he was basically out of action. So based off of General Lincoln's orders to remove the invalids and other, what I would use the term, non-essentials out of Charleston as they got ready for the final stages of the siege, he was transported out of the city, and he was kind of hiding out in and around his plantation and then kind of, you know, hiding from, you know, British and Loyalist patrols. And then he eventually, with about 20 loyal, you know, patriots, made his way to the American Army that was then stationed up in southern North Carolina. And then one of the districts of militia had appealed for a leader to come help them out up in and around what is currently Georgetown, and he accepted that, and that's Georgetown, South Carolina, and he accepted that and went down and kind of started in on his campaign. Now, he was obviously a wanted man by the British, so there was a degree of staying on the move. There was a degree of certainly self-preservation, but also he had been in, you know, revolutionary attire since 1776.
Now, this story sounds a whole like what I learned when I was doing my Special Forces book at Fort Bragg about how guerrilla bands are formed and why you reach out and you send advisors and special forces to help them out. This sounds like a really familiar American story to me.
Yes, sir. It's a story that we've got several chapters on.
And we've gotten real good at. Explain to people what it means to go guerrilla. In other words, conventional armies are not working, and you decide to go irregular and use irregular warfare tactics against a standing army like the British.
Yes, the big problem with the British that made them susceptible to guerrilla warfare was their reliance upon supplies and their reliance upon, at that time, what we would consider higher technology than what you had here in the colonies at the time. So the guerrilla is allowed a degree of freedom of movement in that he's not part of a military hierarchy to where he's taking orders from a perhaps distant headquarters. So he has freedom of movement. He is able to, if he's lucky and he's in his home turf, blend in with the population, travel very light, and rely upon friendlies or rely upon the land to gather his food. He's able to gather weapons from the fallen enemy whenever he encounters them and is successful. And then you gradually start to wear down your opponent, and you start to gradually gain strength as well. There's a lot of psychological aspect to this as well, and if you're a successful guerrilla, you're able to leave it in your opponent and your enemy's mind that you could be anywhere, and it's just a matter of seconds, minutes, or hours before you're engaging them.
We're going to talk more about Francis Marion and guerrilla warfare during the American Revolution, but I wanted to just say, if you'd like to talk to the Colonel, myself, or both of us, or make a comment, please feel free to call in. Our call-in number is 347-945-7246. Again, 347-945-7246. Now, how long does it take Marion to go and get his guerrilla forces organized? I mean, obviously he's going to want to go and produce more and larger guerrilla cells across a wider footprint of the Carolinas and Georgia. But what does he start out with, and how does he organize it?
Well, he didn't wait long. On the first recorded instance I have of him actually engaging the enemy above, with the exception of a couple of reconnaissances that he conducted, was in August the 20th of 1780 at a place called Horse Creek. And what happened here was he had gotten word, very short notice, that the British were moving contingents of prisoners that they had captured at the Battle of Camden down to Charleston for incarceration. So he organized his men very quickly and struck early one morning, or very early in the morning, and released about 150 prisoners and captured some British units that were their guards. Again, a fairly light guard, but a guard no less. And that initial success rang up and down the colonies, and there's reports of it all up and down in the different colonial newspapers. And so he made fairly quick fame early on. So it didn't take him long at all. Again, he had some loyal followers who had no doubt been with him in the militia during the French and Indian War leading into the events up to independence, and also he kind of fell in on, one of the militia units already. So these guys were pretty well trained, particularly with marksmanship, horsemanship, which were, I think, their two key skills that they needed for success in this type of campaign, followed by just a general knowledge of the lay of the land, and then also being able to read the land and attack your enemy at the right time in the right place.
Very much hit and run, strike and get out of the way, take what you're going to, leave what you don't need and destroy it. In other words, all sorts of the things that we would expect raiding type forces to do today. Talk a little bit about the men who followed Marion. What kinds of men were they? What was their demographic? What social structure did they come from?
Okay, they were the men that followed Marion were really focused around the geographics of where he would be familiar with, kind of around the PD and Santee Rivers. There are a lot of descriptions of the actual men. There's note that they were drawn from small farmers who lived along the Black and the PD Rivers. There's references to Scotch-Irish men from the Black Mingo region. Then there's also a description saying it's a blend of Huguenots of the Santee and Scots of the PD. So you do have a degree of the Scotch-Irish and Huguenots that would be fighting. There's also some indication of freedmen and slaves of African-American ancestry that were fighting. We know that Oscar, his manservant, was with him and was fought alongside him during this time. And then there's some research I've seen about some American Indians actually participating as well. Obviously not as part of an organized tribe, but perhaps men who had assimilated into colonial society at that time. So, again, you kind of have a pretty diverse group of individuals.
What did these people have in common? Were they all people who had experience out in the woods as hunters, trappers? I mean, what was their common bond other than the fact someone was screwing with their home territory?
I believe that's it. It's kind of they're the homeboys, they're the locals, and I think they were a large degree of farmer, and at that time the farmers would obviously go out hunting and everything. So you have a very large rural contingent, and I would say they're exclusively a rural counterinsurgency.
And these people knew how to shoot, obviously.
Yes, sir. They did.
Now, what kind of weapons would they have had at this time? Would they have been like the insurgents of today, who would be going and scrounging weapons from the enemy, the occupying force, or were they using indigenous weapons? What kind of a mix of weaponry did they have?
Oh, that anything they could get their hands on. There's reports that at very early on they took and from some of the plantations, some of the Sauls, and actually beat homemade swords out of them. So you've got homemade swords, you have shotguns, you have muskets, you have long rifles, and then as they continue to fight, you will receive, you know, the brown besses and some of these other weapons from the enemy. But there is always, through this period, a time to where militia commanders are riding each other or riding the main American army asking for gunpowder. So this was a very much a hand-to-mouth organization with regard to supply. And I would imagine that there were times when ammo was getting low, and one guy looks at the other, and he has ammo, but it won't fit in the other guy's weapon because of, you know, incompatibility of make and model. So there's challenges out there, but again, if you rely upon the individual militiaman or the individual partisan to kind of come with as much as they personally have, I think that helps mitigate the supply.
How quickly does the name the Swamp Fox begin to be attached to Marion and his band of insurgents?
That's a good question. There's a tale that British Lieutenant Colonel Bannister Tarleton actually coined the term fox to Marion as he was chasing him along one of the rivers, and that he basically says it's for this old fox, let's leave him and go after the gamecock, which would mean Thomas Sumner, and they broke off their chase and, you know, headed towards Sumner at that time. So the word fox and Marion was linked together quite early on in his partisan campaign, but the actual swamp fox that we think of as him now, I'm not so sure the general populace of South Carolina would have called him that specifically during the American Revolution. I think the popularity of that moniker kind of came on afterwards, but there was a historical evidence back to Lieutenant Colonel Tarleton of the British Army actually calling him a fox.
Not one of the nice men.
No, sir.
Yes, you sound like a Carolinian when you say that, and you're being polite. Let's ask this question. You were talking a little earlier about the fact that his early exploits, including that rescue of POWs, which may in fact be the very first American POW rescue in history, now that I think about it, but that really started giving him a reputation far and wide. How fast did that grow? And at the same time, what is it to have a reputation like that? What is it to be so well known, feared, respected, and thought of that you have a name separate from colonel or general or whatever?
Right. I think that for General Marion, the name actually had more positive impact than negative. The negative impact was obviously soon after the Horse Creek episode, in which the POWs were snatched under the nose of the British. Some of the local British commanders started to notice that Marion was going to be a threat, and they actually started trying to position forces against him. There's two times in his campaign that he actually moved out of the area. One time he actually went up into North Carolina just to kind of let the heat settle down a little bit before he came back down. We would today call it a strategic withdrawal, obviously. But by and large, I think the name of Marion or Marion's men or Marion's brigade, depending on how people would pick up on that, but for the loyalist, I think that it was a potent adversary that they either had to be on their guard for or try to avoid. And, of course, if they tried to avoid Marion, then that would almost suffice in putting them completely out of action. And then it also was, I think, a beacon for guys that were on the Patriot side that wanted a good commander that they knew would provide them success with the minimum amount of bloodshed. And we see that in some of Marion's early parts of his campaign when he had a large freedom of movement.
I want to talk more about that, but before we do, I want to talk a little about you and what drew you to this subject. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from? What made you want to become a Marine officer? And what drew you to this rather interesting man?
Okay. Very quickly, I'm the Fleet Marine Officer at the U.S. Fleet Forces Command in Norfolk, so I'm the senior Marine on a Navy staff. I'm a Marine Infantry Officer with over 28 years of service, and since 9/11, I did detainee operations in Guantanamo Bay. I was part of the Combined Joint Task Force Horn of Africa in Eastern Africa, to where we were doing combating terrorism operations, and then I have two tours in Iraq. And I guess I joined the Marines largely because my dad was a Marine. I guess you've heard that story before. But
I've heard it from people like Chuck Krulak and others, that it's the family business, so you join the family business.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So, but anyway, my Brigadier General Marion has been my lifelong hero. My journey really began when I was at the Donelson branch of the Nashville Public Library there in Tennessee. I was a young boy and read a book called Francis Marion, Swamp Fox of the Revolution by Burl Williams and Samuel Epstein. And it was the first of many books that I've consumed on Marion since that time, and I've been reading about him since probably 12 or 13 years old as a young boy. So it all started right there in the library, reading the book. And then the book that I wrote is a continuation of my interest on this subject, and it began in the year 2000. I wrote a paper for an irregular warfare class at the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College over there at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. So that's where I was able to take my fascination with Marion and actually put pen to paper and start writing. Again, I graduated from the class, so that's a good thing, so it helped me there. And then I later received practical
application. And so you're unique in that you're a Marine who's also a Jedi Knight.
Well, we're the class of 2000, yes, sir, so they called us that and a few other words, I guess. But I later lived practical application in this type of warfare, specifically in Iraq, although with some degrees of counterinsurgency and combating terrorism in general out of Guantanamo Bay and also out of Djibouti. And then the way I feel about it right now, just to kind of sum it up, is, you know, with my time in Iraq, on a good day, I felt like Marion, and on a bad day, I felt like one of these targets, either a loyalist or a British soldier. So that's kind of how, in Iraq, that was kind of one of the frameworks that I had.
Were you out in Anbar with General Allen when he was there?
I was out in Anbar 2005 and 6.
Okay.
So I think our paths.
Tough
and then
time.
I was out there again in 2009 and 10.
So you got to see both ends of the awakening then.
Yes, sir. Sure did.
Okay. And you said you started looking, in an academic sense at Marion back in 2000 when you were at CGSC. Where does your journey to write a book go from there?
Well, I had previously co-authored a local history with one of my friends, and it came out in 2004. But the book was well on its way when I was at Fort Leavenworth, so the writing was kind of in my blood at the time. And so I was able to say to myself, you know, I believe Marion would be a good subject for a book in regards to modern military tactics. Marion has three very superb biographies out there that I consider classics. One was written in 1956, the other one in 1973, and the third and the most recent in 1982. And these are superb books, and they talk about Marion as the man, and they really are more of a true biography. What I've tried to do with the book that I have put together is look at it from a contemporary military viewpoint, focusing on specifically Marion's leadership and innovation.
And we'll talk more about that as we go through the segment, but I wanted to ask, obviously one of the reasons to do something new on someone who's had other biographies is new things appear, new material opens up. What has what has become new knowledge regarding Marion since 1982, when the previous biography that you respect was published? What's new about the Swamp Fox?
Well, the biggest thing from my eyes that is new, besides the events of history that we've lived since then that have, you know, brought him to my eye, is one of the a former Special Forces man out of South Carolina actually took his Francis Marion's orderly book, which, you know, kind of like his duty log book, and put it to paper. In the past, it had been on microfiche and in some pretty inaccessible locations. So the bringing to light Marion's orderly book to where you can kind of peer into some of the things that was going on with his unit on a more frequent basis, not quite daily, but close to it, really, in my mind, opened up for the average amateur historian the ability to have at their fingertips some of this knowledge of what occurred. So it's like minute detail that one needs when putting together a story.
So in other words, you had the ability to look at him on a day-to-day basis, which, given the media of the day, is about as good as it's going to get from the colonial period, and at the same time, you were able to look at it through a different lens of context, given the way that we now do insurgency and counterinsurgency here in the United States, of course.
Right. I would say that, you know, this book is definitely a product, although my mind of Marion has gone back to when I was about, you know, 12 or 13, this book has truly come into its relevance after the awful events of September the 11th, 2001, and then the wars and campaigns that we've done since then to prosecute our enemies. So it's in my mind, it's a very timely book, and it's a book that, had it been written, you know, in the 80s or the 90s, I don't think it would have the true utility or the true context that it has now.
And that said, let's again tell callers, if you want to come in and talk to the Colonel or myself, our call-in number is area code 347-945-7246. Let's talk a little bit about, okay, he has this great beginning. He's obviously on a bit of a roll. What happens to him in the months after August 1780? Talk a little bit about the major milestones that he deals with, achieves, and overcomes in the months and times ahead.
Yes, up to about the 1st of January 1781, he has, in my mind, a very unprecedented degree of freedom of movement. General Greene is not yet on scene, and there are no large plans by the Patriots to actively move out and start regaining ground there in specifically South Carolina. So during that time, he has several more engagements in which he bests the enemy, and we'll talk more on Georgetown, but he has his first two peeks into the town of Georgetown, which that is interesting. He attacked Georgetown four different times before he finally took over the town, and it's was at that time kind of the second largest town on the coast there, and it was very important with regard to trade and to movement, specifically since Charleston was in British hands. Then when Greene comes on scene around about the first of the year and begins his campaign to recover the South, Marion receives more direction from above on how he should display his forces and position his forces, and it's there where he's in more of the greater good of the colonial cause. During those times, they do have the campaign to where he captured two forts, which I think is pretty interesting for a insurgent force when you're outgunned. And he also, at the time, participated in two stand-up battles, the Battle of Quimby and the Battle of Eutaw Springs. And, of course, the Eutaw Springs was the largest battle down in South Carolina before you have the victory in Yorktown later that October in 1781.
Now, the British weren't just sitting still and being passive here. They obviously were trying to go ahead and counter his efforts. And they clearly had some advantages, obviously one of which was they controlled the coastal areas. And how far inland on the rivers were they able to go ahead and control and use those waterways to their advantage?
Not as far as you would think. I would say they may go about 10 to 15 miles in from the coast in certain rivers, and other rivers maybe a little more. But those rivers, as soon as they kind of got away from the populated areas and kind of out in the open, they ended up to where ships would become susceptible to ground fire, you know, fire from the banks and fire from the shore. So you really see them kind of concentrated, you know, obviously in and around Charleston and in and around Georgetown.
Flip side, were Marion and his forces using boats and the rivers to help them move around and supply themselves? What advantages did they have over the British? You talk about mobility and obviously blending in. What were the other advantages they had over the British on during these days?
Marion did use the rivers. He had several instances to where he could either ford his men, you know, with their horses, or they would have some, you know, flat bottom or other sorts of boats that they could actually boat from bank to bank. And there was one instance to where, in him positioning himself for an engagement against a loyalist force, he covered 90 miles and three rivers in the prosecution of that particular fight. So he could definitely get across the rivers. Again, the best thing is to know where the fords are, because that would obviously be quicker. But there's report after report of his men gathering up on both sides of the river at a certain point, up and down the banks, gathering up all the usable boats, and then either destroying them to keep them out of the British and loyalist hands, or use them for their own effect. So he did have a degree of mobility, but again, I think also his mobility was the fact that he had the horses, and that he was able to scale his forces. And one thing that Marion could do that would prevent having to supply large numbers of troops is he could ebb and flow the size of his force as he needed. He was very judicious in using militias, as he would call them up, and he wouldn't use them for more than he needed. So this did a couple of things. One is obviously keeping his supplies low, but it also allowed his militiamen to stay at their homes and protect their homes, and then also keep the crop cycle going as best they could. So Marion just wouldn't, you know, use the militia because he could. He would use them judiciously.
General Greene comes onto the scene in early 1781, and the thing that he has first and foremost as he's starting to flow his forces into the Carolinas, he has Marion and his men. How does Greene view Marion? How is their command relationship? And what does he want to do with them? How does he want to utilize them to go ahead and beat the British into a losing position?
The first thing he did was use Marion as his eyes and ears. He, right off the bat, prompted Marion when he got into the command of the army to provide him intelligence. So he was really wanting Marion to provide him intelligence, not only on the British forces and the loyalist forces in the area, but on the nature of the terrain. There is some instance to where there's discourse between General Greene and Light Horse Harry Lee, Lieutenant Colonel Light Horse Harry Lee, and Greene tells Lee, well, Marion knows that area. He's the guy we need to go to get the information on that area. So as they would plan their maneuvers, guys like Marion were crucial in telling them the best ways to go, not only by terrain, but also what areas probably had more forage in them at that time than others. So Marion was initially used as the eyes and ears for Greene in certain areas of South Carolina. Then it progresses to where Marion is also on the flip side and is providing Greene with supplies as Marion can scrounge them up. The only part of friction that I can see between Green and Marion. With, well, there's two parts. One was to where I think Green kind of overestimated Marion's ability to gather up new horses for him. And there was a degree of exchange between the two to where there was some frustration vented. And I think that Green eventually found out that Marion was about giving him about the best he could. And, of course, a good horse in those days was pretty much well hidden if you were in a neutral party because you didn't want either side to get your prized possession. So taking horses was a pretty hard business down in that area. And then Green, and so by providing supplies, and then Green also uses Marion and places Marion in what I would refer to as areas that may be concerned considered economy of force. You know, if Green wants to move from point A to point B and he kind of wants to protect his flank, one way to do would be send Marion into that area to kind of stir up trouble. So some of the local British and loyalists would be focused on Marion and allow Green a degree of movement, a degree of freedom of movement to where he could get and accomplish his objectives. Then you start to see towards the back end of the war to where Marion was actually participating in some of the larger battles, again, Quimby in support of Thomas Sumner, and then the Battle of Eutaw Springs in support of Green himself. And Green actually held up a couple of days and waited till Marion linked up with him, and that gave him some of the numbers that he needed to where he knew he could take on the British Army at that time with a degree of feeling that he had a good chance from a combat ratio.
What's the end game of the American Revolution like for Marion and his guerrillas? How do they wind up helping finish off the British and ending this thing?
Well, after Eutaw Springs and then, of course, after the Battle of Yorktown, things were not over down in South Carolina. By this time, you had a pretty good civil war. Well, I shouldn't say pretty good because it wasn't good. It was a pretty bad civil war going on between Tory and Patriot. So there was a degree of civil war that was occurring, South Carolinian versus South Carolinian, just on different sides of the line there. And Marion had his hands full till basically the Treaty of Paris was enacted. And there were some skirmishes and battles after, or skirmishes, not really battles, afterwards. And then, of course, you had some British raiding parties from time to time to where they would go out and try to gather food to feed themselves while they were in Charleston. So although we had the victory at Yorktown, we still had several months there to where Marion had to stay on his toes, and at the time where the heart of the average person was not behind it because they always just assumed that the war was over. So what you had was Marion had a more of a challenge towards the end in keeping his forces focused on what they needed to do to patrol. And, of course, as you well know, in a terrorist attack, you can be diligent 364 days out of the year, but if you're not diligent on the last day, 365, that's when the terrorist might hit and, of course, catastrophic effects. So Marion had to focus on those guys really until the British cleared out of Charleston. But on the flip side, Marion really had an eye towards what I would refer to in what's known as conflict termination. During his war and his campaign, there's three things I saw that Marion did that I think helped bring South Carolina to heal quicker down after the war. First was that during his campaigns, there's some anecdotal evidence that they didn't really go to kill a lot of loyalists because they didn't want to, again, fan the flames of civil war. So if you could disperse a group of Tories, you know, maybe kill a couple of them, but not try to massacre the whole lot, That went a ways towards trying to keep down conflict in the future when kinsman goes after kinsman. Secondly, is what he did was he actually had 2 points during the war where he made local treaties with some of the militia units of the Tories to where they would actually stand down for periods of time, which I thought was, you know, pretty innovative there. And then thirdly, is in his role as a state legislator in the last part of the war and, you know, right after the war, he really fought hard to keep down retribution towards the Tories, as far as he did not sign some of those acts that would, you know, take away the Tories and the Loyalist property, things of that nature. So he really tried to kind of mend some fences there on the back part of his campaign.
And what happens to him when all of this is over? Does he go back to being a quiet country planter? What does he do, and how does his life end?
Well, he had to rebuild his plantation, and he got married. So he's a single man up to that point, and then he got married after the war and started to rebuild his plantation. And he was an esteemed figure throughout. He received like a gold medal from the state legislature for, you know, heroic duty, and he was put on a pension.
And he lived out his life, I assume, peacefully. How old was he when he finally died?
Well, he passed on in, I won't say 1792. I guess, you know, one point about this book is I was so fixated on what he did during the war is I kind of ended it somewhat abruptly, and I ended the book with him with his farewell speech that he gave on November the 30th, 1782. But he did die, and I believe the end of his death, if I'm not mistaken, was about 1792.
All right. Now, Francis Marion, of course, is more than just a war hero and a beloved patriot. He's also a rock star. He's a man who's been depicted lots of times in movies and television and such. And let's talk about him in the media. I will tell you, I am old enough, sir, that once upon a time, I remember a Disney series that would be on the Disney show every Sunday night called The Swamp Fox. And this, of course, was a somewhat fictionalized characterization of Marion per the wonderful mind of Walt Disney. Talk a little bit about that and how close they even got to being in the ballpark reality-wise.
Yes, sir. You know, again, as you said, Swamp Fox was a television series. It was produced by Walt Disney, and they had 8 episodes that aired between 1959 and 1961. I, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you want to look at it, was not on this planet at that time, so I didn't get to see them. But it starred Leslie Nielsen as General Marion, and then they reran the episodes again throughout the 1980s and the 1990s. Then, I guess when you mention rock star, that leads into the movie Patriot in 2000. And one more can I say, Mel Gibson served as played a character that was resembled very much General Marion. So what can I say more? I mean, I guess when I retire, perhaps, you know, if anybody would write a movie, I guess Mel Gibson would be a pretty good guy, for me, that I'd feel pretty good if he, you know, represented me. So, I mean, you can't get better than that. Mel Gibson as Marion. Wow. And that was a big hit in the United States.
Not so much in Great Britain, I've heard. But on the other hand, this is an amazing, you know, and given the period of time that we're talking about from the late 50s to the present day, Marion is still a character that resonates very, very powerfully with the American people. Why do you think that is?
Well, I tell you, he's one of us. I think everybody out there, when they either hear about Marion and hears what he's done, or they read a book about him or someone, would want to sit there and say, wow, I bet I could do that, or wow, I really wish I could do that. So he's one of us. He's a guy that, I mean, when you look at George Washington, God bless General Washington, but he almost seems majestic. He, you know, as far as, you know, very few people I think could even say they could, you know, own.
There's
a
larger than life quality
you
to Washington in the American psyche.
Exactly. And with General Marion, I think, although he was somewhat charismatic at the time, he also comes across as a humble man and a man with great character, great genuine character. You know, in the book, I laid out and compared him against the modern-day Marine Corps leadership traits and principles, and in looking at the comparison, he graded out great. So I think he has just a great character. And again, you know, his idea of, you know, conflict termination, you don't have any, you know, unnecessary blood on his hands. And then, you know, he was successful, and, you know, Americans love a winner.
Well, and let's not sell him short, because I think if he were alive today, there are some great people in Tampa, Florida, at the U.S. Special Operations Command who might like to lay a claim on him too.
Yes, sir. I think he would be, as we referred to, a high demand, low density asset.
Definitely a snake eater to the bone, and I will tell you that they teach about Marion at the John F. Kennedy School and down at the Special Operations University, and they are very and they make it clear the values, the methods, the techniques, all cover the full spectrum of special operations, from the kinds of things Rangers do to special forces, you name it. He certainly is a unique and wonderful character in that regard. Which takes us to the question of, well, you've written your book about him. Actually, you've written two books about him. And what's next for Colonel Aiken and his writing career? You've obviously made a great and wonderful start with the folks from U.S. Naval Institute. What do you have in mind for your next project, if any?
Well, sir, I like writing, and again, right now I've got about three things I'm looking at. I'm still gathering data, and again, my first book was a local history of my hometown there, just out of Nashville. So that was published in 2004. So you can't really write a book of that type for 15 years roughly. So I'm gathering information on it, and you know, hopefully someday either I'll write a second book on my beloved Donelson or pass it off to somebody worthy that could do it for me. But right now I've got two other topics I'm looking at right now. First of all is I'm looking at perhaps writing about this campaign that General Francis Marion conducted, but do a historical fiction and do it through the eyes of one of his privates. I think that would be a challenge and yet something fun to do. And then the last project I'm working on right now is, and hold on to your seat, I've entitled it The Observations of the American Alligator by a 21st Century Naturalist. Who would be me?
Oh, my. I do like alligators.
Yes, sir. Well, being in the Marines, I've been, you know, mostly on the south side of the Mason-Dixon line. I've had a chance to be down in Tampa and down at our main base out of Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and, you know, I'm a frequent kayaker. So I've run across them on numerous occasions. And, again, back when I was at the Donelson Branch Library of the Nashville Public Library System, I had the Francis Marion book in one hand, and I had the book on alligators in the other hand. So these are both lifelong topics of interest to me, and I love nothing more than to write my experiences regarding them.
Well, I'm glad you get along with them. I tend to keep my distance and mostly prefer them breaded and fried and in small bites, but or in a pair of shoes or possibly a suitcase. So I will look with interest in when you do put this out. Colonel,
yes,
I want to
well,
thank
again,
you.
Yes, sir.
I just want to thank you for coming on today and sharing your experiences about this fascinating figure in American history. I hope that our listeners have found it as intriguing as I have. And let's hope we can find a reason to bring you back again someday, sir.
Sir, I appreciate it. And I did look up. It's 1792 was when he died. I said 1792. I'm sorry, not 1792, 1795. So I was off by 3 years.
Okay. well, it's good to hear he got a little bit on extra on the end there. And with that,
yes, sir,
I'm going to say goodbye to you and end the show here.
All righty. Thank you, sir. Appreciate you having
Take
me today.
Take care, Colonel.
All right, sir. Bye.
And with that, we're coming to the end of another edition of Military Monday. And as we did last week with Colonel Bud Day, it's time to say goodbye and rest in peace to another great, great warrior out there. This morning, we got the news from Great Britain that Admiral Sir John Sandy Woodward, the commander of the Falklands Task Force in 1982, died after a long illness. Sandy Woodward was an amazing figure in his own right. He did something which, quite frankly, was borderline impossible in 1982, which is take a Navy which had been badly gutted by deep, deep financial and material cuts, take it to the other side of the world in another hemisphere, and fight a war against a timeline of weather, outnumbered by his Argentine foes, and achieve the goal just in time and did it superbly. Sandy was a good man. He was a kind man. He was a decent man. And we wish he and his family well. And to all the others who fought with him during that nasty little fight down in 1982, we say, remember him, hoist a pint, and good day. This is Military Monday for Monday, August the 5th, 2013. We'll be back again next week. Take care. Please come listen to us.